Welcome to Homeschool Companion, your source for information, motivation, and inspiration. If you're part of the homeschool community or simply interested in learning more about home-based education, stay tuned. Together, we'll examine the latest resources, learning styles, and teaching techniques. We'll speak with experts in the field to help you uncover every homeschool advantage. We'll also present suggestions on how to keep Christ in the curriculum as we explore fresh ways to teach and learn. Here's your homeschool companion host, author, educator, and children's ministry specialist, Dr. Rose Gamblin.
Welcome, welcome. You know, we've been talking about questions parents ask, and I had shared earlier with you that I knew all the answers to all of the questions parents might ask when I first started teaching. And then 2 years later, I had my first child. And this first child was so hyperkinetic that I had to be on high alert 24/7. Then my second child was born just a little over a year later, and she was very laid back. And I still, in my mind, had this picture of this blood-curdling scream and running to see my little two-year-old son with his father's trumpet without the mouthpiece on it. And so he had cut his lip and blood's dripping down him and the trumpet from him trying to play this trumpet at 2 years old. And, you know, taking care of that and it being so quiet in the house and then hearing this scraping noise and looking and seeing my little girl in her little, you know, onesies, pajamas, she couldn't crawl. I mean, she was only about 2 months old, but I'd left her on the floor and she had just scraped along until she'd found us and just quiet and happy and content, but, you know, did want a little bit of human connection. And that kind of sums up how her childhood was, because I was running from one catastrophe to the next with my hyperkinetic little boy. And so my daughter grew up in that shadow, and she tended to be very sociable and very easy to manage. But then, you know, as time progressed, she had her own sets of challenges, as we all do in our human experience. She had a pretty severe learning disability, and we struggled through that, crying and just, you know, wondering as a parent. And all of the things that have happened to us now, we sit here, my husband and I, Mike Gamblin, and our oldest grandchild is now 18 years old. So we look at all of the experiences that we have had, that our children have had, and with their children now, and we do humbly give advice, knowing that it was only as we experienced it for ourselves that we became less confident in the advice that we gave and relied more fully on the Holy Spirit to connect with our minds towards that person. So it is through this crucible, this bridge of human experience, that we bring you part two of What Parents Ask. And here to moderate is my husband, my best friend, and show producer, Michael Gamblin.
Hello there. What she did not tell you, though, is we have 10 grandkids.
Yes.
Not just one. We have 10.
Yes. Our children have been very fruitful. And
multiplied.
And they are getting paid for their raising, which we look at with great satisfaction and a smirk now and then between the two of us.
You know, this next question comes to us, and I look back at some other people I have known and seen, and I can see the trap they fall into because of the fact that they are constantly dealing with kids, work, and all the things that come with life as you grow up. The question is, my husband has become very distant with me, and I find myself attracted to another man at work. I really think my husband wouldn't mind if I found someone else. We are too poor for a marriage counselor. What should I do?
I think that all marriages need to be renegotiated on a regular basis, because you grow and you change, and dissatisfaction tends to beget dissatisfaction, and satisfaction begat satisfaction. So when you get into this thing where you feel like your husband's being distant with you, well, guess what? He probably feels that you are being distant with him. And so there's this coldness that's growing between the both of you. And it does, it's a trap that Satan sets. He sets it, and he sets it well, and we fall into it. And it's a spiral. So how do you break the spiral? You cannot change your spouse. You cannot make him become warm and fuzzy toward you. You can't do that. The only person you can change is yourself. And if you can't afford marriage counseling, then you have to give yourself marriage counseling. The Bible, the Word, has so many good tools for you. Love, first of all, is long-suffering. It is patient. It is kind. And it doesn't give up. And so you decide on a plan. You write down that plan and you work your plan. You are in a committed relationship. And no matter what, you are going to work your plan. And you will be so surprised how God, if you prayerfully do this, you will look back and you will see how God has reconstructed your relationship. And when you come to the end of your life, so many couples, as I have been involved and they laid a spouse to rest, wish they had done things differently. Part of them has died when their spouse died, and yet they treated that part with disrespect, unkindness, criticize them, found fault with them. And you can make a decision right now, right this day, that you will lead your life differently, and that when you come to that point where you are saying goodbye on this earth to your spouse, you will have no regrets, because you know you lived with honor and respect toward that person all the days of their life.
I have heard a little saying that I like very much. What would Jesus do?
That's right.
How would they treat that person? How would they go about it? If you keep that in mind, I think you can solve a lot of your own problems. Like you say, though, you can only change yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, next question. Oh, listen up. How do you get over feeling imprisoned by your circumstances? I'm a young, unemployed father, so my wife has to work, and I have the kids. It is driving me crazy. Help!
Now, I imagine it's driving this young man crazy on so many levels. First of all, the man is used to being the main breadwinner. That's our culture, even though it's changed some. There's still that belief, and our young men are raised to be the providers and the protectors of their family. Second of all, there's this thing in human nature that we often laugh and say it's the golden rule, whoever holds the gold rules.
Mm-hmm.
When the wife or the man become the main breadwinner, the power in the relationship shifts. And it takes some maturation to look at it and not allow that to happen. So on both parts, the man and the wife need to sit down, and they need to guard against that power shift with the money shift. What is yours is mine. What's mine, yours. And, you know, we're providing for the family. It's our resources. No matter who's bringing it in, it's our resources. And that's something that has to be guarded against. I'm here to tell you that almost every young man that I know of has gone through this experience where they lost their job and now they are the stay-at-home dad, so to speak, and it is pretty frustrating. So you're not the only one in that situation, but men don't tend to form support groups for stay-at-home dads. They should, but they don't tend to. So give yourself just take a breath. I'm here to say that this too shall pass. That's a very famous saying that Abraham Lincoln said, but guess what? It's so true. This too shall pass. Your kids will grow up, you'll find a job, and you have an opportunity to have this powerful, powerful influence. In fact, I have to just take a moment and say, this happened to my dad. He did not, he lost his job. He was a teacher. He lost his job and he was a stay-at-home dad. I was 3 and 4. My brother was 4 and 3. It was about 2 years. And our best memories are of when my dad was our main caregiver and our mother worked, because our dad was just this creative, fun-loving, playful.
Halfway crazy, but...
Yes, and we have these wonderful memories. He made the very best of it. My mother, you know, when she stayed home, she did mother things like clean the house and wash the dishes and wash the clothes. My dad, when he stayed home, he built things. Our living room became this, you know, foam houses and tunnels and... And the whole place took on a very imaginative, fun thing. So, fathers, if you find yourself imprisoned, take advantage. Make it the best memorable experience, because your child will never travel that way again. We never had that opportunity again. We never got to see our father that way again once he went back to work.
Isn't there, though, a chance that because it's so traumatic for the man to lose his job, that they fall into a depression as well?
I've seen
this in other cases, too, mm-hmm. where it felt like they have gone into a deep depression after losing their job.
Right, and that's why we're having this radio show, because we're saying snap out of it, you know, make the best out of it, and make it a memorable experience for your child or your children.
Yeah, and get professional help if you need to for the depression, because it takes you, sucks you down a hole that you will not.
And you know, knowing my father's nature, he could have become very depressed.
Right.
But you know, we made kites out of newspaper and sticks and ran out in the dirt and those kinds of things. You really can't stay depressed too long if you actually embrace what and see the child.
He basically grabbed his own bootstraps and pulled himself out. And he said, "We're going
right.
to have fun with this."
Yeah, we're going to be joy. You know, I can't talk enough about it, the power of joy. We're going to be joyful in this experience. We're talking about questions that parents have asked. We'll be right back.
He's so into sports, he must be a pea-brained jock. He wears nothing but black, he must be depressed. She wears so much makeup, she must be a stuck-up wannabe. That's right, stereotypes. When you label each other just for their appearances or habits, stereotypes can really hurt others and make them view themselves in a downgrading way. Even when you're just joking, it can still affect someone. Like calling someone a nerd just because they got a good grade in a test can make them feel self-conscious about themselves and possibly make them stop trying so hard at getting good scores. So remember, labeling people is wrong. And if you notice others or yourself stereotyping people, please, put a stop to it.
This Kids Talk moment was brought to you by Baltimore White Marsh Adventist School. For more information, go to www.bwmschool.org.
Okay, next question. We have one child who has just turned 6 years old. I wanted to keep him home as long as possible, but my husband feels strongly that we should send him to school. When is the best age to start a child in school?
Well, she sounds like a very nurturing and caring mother. And of course, we know that the best, the most ideal school is the home school. In fact, your home will forever be your school till you graduate from it and emancipate as an adult. Even if you're going to a traditional school, you're still learning so much in your home. And this mother wants the very best for her child, but maybe the father is seeing a child that is being, you know, excluded or needs a little more exposure to socialization, how to get along with others. Maybe it's the only child in the family, which I know it is in this situation. When it's the only child in the family, that child doesn't have the interaction of brothers and sisters and learns those skills, those negotiating skills and how to deal with conflict and sharing. And those skills can only be learned really from peer to peer. It's almost impossible if there's one child in an adult world for them to learn how to relate to their peers. So I think that under these circumstances, the child may be 6 years old and maybe they're could be a
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. At being a six-year-old, most people think that you have to put them into first grade. But do you have other options of that if you haven't already started them in school? Can they go to like a preschool half day or something like that to ease them into this type of school setting?
They can. They're still available, just morning kindergarten programs. It's becoming more and more mandatory that a child go to a full kindergarten day. But it's totally, I mean, you'd probably have to go to a private school, you know, a private school system to find it, but it's readily available. And in that part-time situation, then they have a chance to learn how to get along with other children. They get to be involved in the programs and learn how to be up in front of other people and how to conduct themselves with poise. And I think that's very important because in real life, we're not going to get to be in the nurturing environment of our family. We are in our families preparing us for real life here on this earth and the earth to come.
With that being said, do you have any suggestions where a parent might find some of these daycares? Or how would you go about finding some of these? Just drive around? Or what?
Well, you can, you know, there's websites that's, you know, findmyschool.com. And then there's different religious affiliated school systems. There's the Lutheran school system, the Catholic school system, the Seventh-day Adventist school system, a number of schools in the Baptist school system that have kindergarten programs that give you an option. Some schools will even say that you can do a number of days, like you can do 3 days. And other school systems, the one I currently work with, we give them they can do half day option. And, you know, because kindergarten still is resting in the afternoon and doing center time, which is a fun time, but it's still not the core subjects that we're teaching in the morning. So they get their core subjects done in a recess, and then they can go home. That's very nice for a mother who wants to still have a lot of influence in her child's life. And then when she does decide to send him full-time, she can volunteer at that school. She can get a job as a substitute teacher at that school or a teacher's aide at that school.
Oh, there's a lot of things they can do.
Yes, there's so much
you can do. The home and school or the PTA, whatever they call it and everything. So, okay. My 3-year-old daughter has started biting. She has bitten me, the dog, my husband, our grandmother. You get the picture. I don't believe in corporal punishment, but my mother-in-law is pretty upset. She says we need to get her under control before she comes around again.
So I'm assuming that the mother-in-law got bit. And that is, it's always startling. I know that I have been, you know, just innocently cooking something at the stove and had one of my grandchildren in the behind. It was quite startling, and it was a nice strong bite too. And usually just the reaction of being startled, you know, I swung around and sent that poor little kid flying across the room, and I have not ever been bit since by any of the grandkids. I don't know if my reputation precedes me, but it's not that I beat on the kid or anything. It was just the natural consequence of being so startled. I didn't even touch the kid. I just yelled and turned around quickly. 3-year-olds, is it a 3-year-old?
Yes, it's a 3-year-old daughter.
3-year-olds, 2 and 3-year-olds tend to go through a biting stage, and part of it is affection. They are beginning to discover in their own autonomous state the love that they have for this other human being. And so it's not so malicious as it's an act of affection, but it has to be eradicated.
Well, what about biting them back?
Well, you know, as a parent, I think I bit my kids back, but
not hard, of course, but yet.
But so many of us are involved in taking care of other people's children, and so we can't bite them back. I had a child in the child development center that would not stop biting. And so we started making like if we were going to bite them. And So we would make our hand like a mouth, and we make our mouth, and we would cut, must have looked pretty horrible. When I look in the mirror at it, I would be scared, and I would come like if I like if my mouth was going to bite them and my hand was going to bite them, and it was so startling and probably horrifying for the child that it did stop. It did extinguish the behavior, but we tried other things first. You know, we tried no, you know, and time out, and they just it wasn't comprehending until we actually at the time of the bite would come back at them, you know, with our mouths open, ready to bite them, and they got the message. So there is a way to do it, and even if you're not doing corporal punishment, you are, as a parent, doing some kind of corrective measures.
Oh, we've got a good one here now. How old should a child be to begin potty training?
You know, there's something about potty training that has changed through the ages. When we had the cloth diapers, we tended to potty train our children earlier. And there's other things, I think, that contribute to the fact that our children are being potty trained later. One of the factors is the diaper thing. We have diapers now that can hold a lot, and it's so much easier to just change the diaper than it is to constantly be training. The training part is just that. It takes time. You can't just instantly train them. You have to keep working at it. So the diaper situation, another reason that our children tend to be training later in life is that I think some of the immunizations cause the bowels to react differently. It causes the whole flora, that biome in the bowel, to be a different consistency. So we have children who can't sense when they're going to have a bowel movement. It's numb. They cannot sense. And so those children just don't train early. And parents are so frustrated with it. But I think there's a physiological reason for that they need to take into consideration. Gender differences, girls tend to train earlier than boys, but I'm still seeing that the girls aren't training until 3 years. And I know I was trained at 9 months. You know, so my generation to that generation, it really has changed. And then probably the biggest thing that I worry about is the parents who get so upset about their children having accidents that it causes more accidents. You know, I had one family that the way they punished their child, they threw him in cold showers every time they messed. You know, they threw him in cold showers. I can't help but think that is on the borderline of abuse. You know?
Oh, definitely.
God loves us in all our poopy messes, doesn't he?
He does.
We probably won't be trained from our poopy messes metaphorically until we get to heaven. But he loves us in spite of that. He takes care of us. And I know that he wants us, even when we're potty training a child, to look at that child with immeasurable value, that every part of them, even their excrement, is of value. So, you know, with that being said, I know we've come to the end of our show.
Yes, we have.
But you know how frightening it is for a parent when all the bodily functions aren't working properly. And we just have to remember that God created every part of us to survive on this planet, and he loves you very much. And we have one last thing to say, and that is
God bless. You have been listening to Homeschool Companion, a production of MRG Media. Be sure to join us on Facebook. Just type in the name Homeschool Companion. For more on this or to contact us, go to mrgmediaministries.com. That's all one word, mrgmediaministries.com.